This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Welcome to LGIM Talks. I'm your host, Mark Chappell. Unintentionally, we've created a bit of a theme on the podcast for the last few months. This episode is one that really links up very well with the ones we did earlier in the summer, with Richard Romilly on Absolute Return, how we can make pension statements better and easier to read, and the episode we did with Helena Morrissey about technology and how it can be used to improve investor experiences. All of these episodes form a theme about how we as an industry are communicating with clients and how we can better engage them about investing itself. This week, we're continuing that conversation by focusing on the experience of advisors and how they're approaching this particular challenge. Joining us this week from LGIM is Matt Kemp, Senior Investment Sales Manager. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
No problem. It's a pleasure, Mark.
Always great to have you. And we're also delighted to be joined by Andy O'Shea, Investment Director at Fairon Independent Financial Advisors. Andy, welcome to LGIM Talks.
Hello, Mark. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Of course. Now, Matt, before we start, in doing a bit of research about you, I suddenly found that you'd edited a West Ham fanzine called Over Land and Sea. Now, tell us a bit about this.
Indeed. I'm actually an avid West Ham fan.
And well, I would hope so. But writing for and editing a fanzine about West Ham, you would assume that you're a fan yourself.
Well, there's a few of us at Legal & General, and I won't name and shame them, but some of them have actually been on some of your previous podcasts. So I'll let you guess on that. But no, I wanted to be a sports journalist and wrote for a fanzine called Overland Sea, sadly no longer with us. And part of that allowed me to go to the training ground, Chapel Heath, where I interviewed a number of the players. But I sort of fell into finance. So when I was at university, I actually invested my student loan into a UK smaller companies fund, made quite a good return.
FTSE 250 did very well then.
Indeed. But I clearly recognised I wasn't the norm because my peers at university were investing in something else. It was the student bar.
Yeah, I mean, less good return, but a good time.
Inflation's put the price up a little bit, but it was always cheap at the NUS bar.
You know, time in the market, that's what they say, Matt.
Exactly.
And Andy, how do you spend your time when you're not advising clients? Like you mentioned before we started that you were taking unique rally cars around Europe with your son. That sounds fascinating. Tell us about that.
Exactly. 4 years ago, my son and I were fortunate enough to be able to purchase a rally car done by Ginetta, which is a British sports car maker. Who launched one rally car as a testbed for a one-make series.
Wow.
Unfortunately, after 18 months, the one-make series was disbanded, and they only ever built the one car, and we now own it.
Truly one of a kind.
Very much so. So my son and I go around the UK at events such as Silverstone Classic, Carfest, which used to be a Chris Evans thing for Children in Need and other children's charities, as well as through Europe.
Fantastic.
So it's a good way of blowing off steam.
Yeah.
Having to build portfolios with risk-adjusted returns, it's a good way of relaxing.
Yes, exactly. Travelling the south of France with a unique rally car, coming back and dealing with diversification.
Like, exactly.
It balances nicely. So, gents, I'd like to take this all the way back to the basics and talk about performance. So the main thing, and perhaps not the only thing, but the main thing clients focus on in their conversations is often performance of their funds, performance of their portfolio overall. Andy, how do you talk about performance with clients?
With conversations with our clients, it all stems from how much we can generate above cash. Cash is their ultimate benchmark. We might have to put in a peer group average or an index average, but for the base client, it is, I know that I can get X in the bank, what can you offer me?
Yeah.
And as long as we can outperform that cash benchmark, the client's happy. Over the longer term, it sounds relatively easy. But with the client shortening time horizons, it's becoming much more difficult.
I can imagine so. So over time, it's very easy to say, well, over time, stocks delivered, 6% per average, 6% per annum on average. And yet when a fund or their portfolio falls below cash, as you say, and you say, well, it's not fallen as much as the peer group, that's not as comforting to a client who's really looking to beat that cash return that they could be promised from a savings account.
No, you're correct. And that is when holding a client's hand is exceedingly important. Whilst you can provide them with the hard figures, which are now generated by platforms or DFMs or, you know, in this day and age, just log online and view it yourself. But it's in training or educating the client to actually understand. As long as you can see through the current noise, the longer-term picture is much clearer and much more has greater upside.
Absolutely. So Matt, what can you tell us about, what have you seen in the market about this kind of shortening of time horizons, where people are looking for that real short-term performance, a kind of in all market scenarios, no matter what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, just go back to performance. Is how do you actually measure performance? Mm. I think a lot of clients now are moving away from conventional benchmarks. We've had a 10-year bull market, so most people should be pretty pleased with the return they've had. One client in particular, he uses Consumer Price Index, which is a measure of inflation. So they think they should be linking the client's return to that with a little bit excess. And if you think when CPI was introduced to the UK, I think 1997, that's never fallen. So just because the stock market falls, your benchmark shouldn't relatively fall as well. Short-term performance, I always look at the graphs that we produce and the literature, and we sort of say you should have at least a five-year horizon. Mm-hmm. For me, that is fairly short-term. Clearly, there are reasons why you'd want to sell. It might be a fund manager change or just constant underperformance. But what clients are is they're asset allocators. They look at valuation metrics. Yep. And that concerns me to an extent. If you look at the US, it's been deemed very expensive. But mm-hmm. in the last 5 years, if you held a US index, you would have had, say, about 100% return. That's going up to sort of May this year. But all I ask our clients is not to sell in May and go away.
Yeah, completely. And it's those kind of like short-term drawdowns that can have such a outsized emotional impact on investors. Andy, what would a normal conversation about kind of that drawdown risk, of the risk that you can't promise everything in all markets, how are clients receptive to that? How would you go about communicating this?
We go through it. The conversation is all about diversification, mm-hmm. and trying to talk the client through why we have bond funds, why we have property funds, why we have infrastructure funds, and why we have equity funds. The design is to try and get them to perform at different times of the market cycle. And a client, we will look at a portfolio that we've built and factor on one fund and go, well, that's underperforming. Why are you continuing to hold it? We had a conversation with a client the other week, and he was querying why we were holding a particular Asian fund, mm-hmm. which had underperformed its peer group and was dragging down the returns of his portfolio. We explained that, yes, it had underperformed its peer group. It was only up 10% year to date compared to the peer group of 13. So it was underperforming. But the portfolio has gone through a transitional period where new team has come in. We've met the team. We like the team. We're happy with that. They're not necessarily going to change the investment approach, but they don't want the same funds as the previous manager held. So we've talked through it with them.
Yep.
We're happy with it. So it's retained there. So we've got a fund that's done 10, a peer group done that's 13. And the client's saying, but that's impacting my overall portfolio.
You're dragging it down with only 10%, 10% return.
So we then had to discuss the rest of the portfolio and embarrassingly turn around to the client that year to date, you're up 22%. And the peer group that you gave us to benchmark against is up 12%.
I think that's such a fascinating point, because what level of performance? Like, it's very hard for any client to say, well, this is high enough for me to be satisfied. And I think for individual clients, it all varies of, is 2% a return because above inflation, 2 to 5% good enough? Is it, in this case, 22% or 10% for an individual fund? Is that high enough? There's always that, I want this to be higher. I think I could be getting more from something else. How can you have that conversation with clients about setting those expectations?
Well, we've had that conversation, and it was very difficult, because the client's immediate response to that's 22% against 12. Mm. That's fantastic. I'm really happy, but I'm very nervous. Does that mean you're taking on much greater risk to achieve that return? So we sat down and we went through the figures with the client, which is always encouraged, and we've actually taken less risk. The annualised volatility today on that portfolio is 6.19 against the peer group, 6.88. Mm-hmm. So we've actually taken on less risk. Part of it is luck.
Yep.
There is always a degree of luck. You look through the figures, you chat to the fund management team, you do your due diligence, but there's a degree that still comes down to gut feeling. And whilst on paper, Fund A might be better than Fund B, your gut's telling you B is better.
Yeah.
And that's quite interesting. But it's a conversation with a client, so they are happy with what you're doing, mm-hmm. happy with understanding how you are doing what you're doing. And ultimately, if a client doesn't understand and isn't comfortable with what we're doing, don't use us.
Yep.
Challenge it. Throw it out. But don't just blindly take it.
So what I feel like I've taken from that is very much about the transparency, is that you're very much very clear about why it is that you have done, that you have organized the funds and chosen this particular investment path for that client on the basis of their outcome or desired outcomes. And here are the reasons why. And
very much so. Very much so. And it's tailoring what we try and impart to the client with what the regulator wants us to impart. Mm. Because the regulator has the best, you know, aims and intentions for generating information to the client. But if you present it in a black and white basis of just a sheet of paper that says, here's your portfolio, here's your charges, they don't understand.
No.
You know, it's a number.
There's not that basis of financial education that you can assume on the basis of from a client.
No, and it's very much a case of wood for the trees. If you throw so much information at a client, they will either become demoralised, mm-hmm. confused, nervous, or just plain bored.
Not any of those that you would actually want from a client experience. Matt, to move this on... It feels like we're getting this element of cautiousness and riskiness, as Andy was just mentioning, from his client across the market with Trump, with Brexit. Are people quite worried about the rest of the year and further beyond, are you finding?
Yeah, I mean, we're sort of mid to late cycle in our thought process, but that still means you should have equity exposure and so on. And you don't really want to miss out, because if you become too cautious, then you're just going to stick it in cash. Mm. In inflation terms, you're therefore losing money. I think clients also are worried about losing money for their end clients. So it becomes a very difficult game there. But I think at the moment we've had some very good returns from the equity market. I alluded to a 10-year bull market earlier on, and I'm still fully invested and enjoying the ride.
Yeah. This point that we've been mentioning about diversification is so important for that purpose, because as you say, it's an equity bull market. But at the same time, you don't want to be clients don't want to be assuming too much of the risk. So they don't want to stomach that much volatility that might potentially come with an equity bull market. Andy, when you approach this issue of diversification, and Matt, do feel free to jump in here, how do you approach, when building your models, this right balance of assets to ensure enough diversification and enough risk, but also not too much risk for your clients?
Well, diversification is trying to encompass as many asset classes as you can. And previously, that was holding 20, 30 different funds to try and capture different sources of alpha. And minimise risk, reduce correlation. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is when you present a client with a list of 20 or 30 funds, they can't see the wood for the trees. It's pure blind panic. And that, in turn, leads to a breakdown in trust and ultimately could lead to a detrimental sale, because the client just doesn't feel in control,
No. Doesn't
feel like they understand. And that's where we've actually started changing our approach to portfolio construction, where we will bring in a multi-asset fund, be it actively managed or passively managed, because there's some very good passively managed funds out there. And we will have a core of multi-asset. And then where, through our strategy team meetings, we actually see areas of niche opportunity, we will bring in an active manager fund to bolt on the side. So you've always got your core spread of your equity, fixed interest, but you then bring in the alternative asset classes around the edge, where you can have most bang for buck.
So interesting. Matt?
Yeah, I mean, lots of my clients now use in managed portfolio services, and there's a lot of external companies that offer risk tools which will deliver the risk of the client, and the models can be managed that way. What you really want is asset classes that are uncorrelated and will behave very differently to give you that outcome.
Can you give me some examples then, Matt?
Well, I think we've got to be transparent on the funds first and foremost, because if there's a fund manager that's got a robust, repeatable process that delivers the right outcome, then clients should be happy with that. But you could have a variety of different funds. So clearly you could go global rather than being regional in equities, or you could take the view that I want to be more regional because certain markets are cheaper. For example, the UK, Europe, US looks expensive but still delivers. And then you want alternatives. So you could be looking at infrastructure, commodities, property around the edges.
Andy, do you use any of these alternatives? Infrastructure, for instance, is such an interesting area.
Yes, we do. It's a relatively recent addition on the infrastructure side, and we've opted to go with a fund that employs quite a large percentage of his assets to ESG and alternative energy sources. So you've got solar, you've got wind, but also water. Mm-hmm. So it's utility type companies. Because you're then almost encompassing two different asset classes within the one fund.
Entirely.
Property, we used to use bricks and mortar.
Okay.
And we used to use a reasonable amount until we bailed out in May 2016.
And was that for liquidity reasons or just a natural kind of reallocation?
Partly liquidity issues. But also, because I'm a bit long in the tooth, having been nearly 30 years here, it was a case of feeling a deja vu. We've been here before. I can remember the property with profit, the property investment bonds, where it was going great guns until.
Yeah.
And it just felt a bit toppy. So we took the decision to write to our clients and pull them out. And they accepted our recommendation, because unfortunately we are only advisory rather than discretionary through choice. But so it is a case of writing to your clients, and they took our advice.
To press you a little bit on that, that's such a big communication undertaking that you need to communicate this kind of view that you've had as asset allocators to all of your clients, but also not only communicate that this is the way we view things differently, but also to persuade them. What kind of process have you gone through as advisors to, you know, persuade clients that this is absolutely the right choice and here's why?
I mean, we're fortunate in so much as we are now dealing with two generations on from the original clients. I mean, we launched in 1973. We dealt with what are now the grandparents, then the parents, and now we're on the grandkids.
Yeah.
So it is very much a trust, and it's getting to the point where they know how we work, they know what we do, and they are comfortable. But also important that we fully understand what they are aiming to achieve.
I'd say, I mean, there's so much information out there on the World Wide Web now, the newspapers and so on. So clients are fairly well educated with what's going on in the world. So they've all got the views. And actually, as a D2C, you can go online to a platform. You can actually throw in a few numbers, time periods, and already you've got the data. Mm-hmm. Obviously, past performance isn't a guide to the future. I better put that one in there for compliance. But, you know, they get a rough idea of what the return could be and how it's performed and the asset class itself.
Okay. To broaden this discussion on perhaps alternatives to your core portfolio holdings, I'd like to touch on thematics, which is definitely an area of investment that's really kind of expanded since 5-10 years ago. I mean, these were very much niche holdings that were quite difficult for retail investors to access. We're no longer talking about the old-fashioned kind of tech and healthcare, and those were being like the themes where these are just sector funds. We're talking about cybersecurity, robotics, these kind of ones. Andy, are you looking at these sort of thematic areas in your asset allocation decisions?
We are. There are various, obviously, climate change is a massive issue.
A massive area.
And it's not just growing temperatures. It's the environmental migrancy that it causes. Mm-hmm. So with rising sea levels, you end up with the islands, which are obviously being encroached, which is reducing the land mass, which is forcing the natives off to other geographic areas. Mm-hmm. Also is water. You know, if you've got a finite amount of water on the island, rising sea levels, suddenly it becomes desalinated.
A much scarcer resource.
Exactly. And it's those sort of things that are growing of importance and interest.
Matt, for your view on the market, are thematics becoming a much bigger part of advisors or even just the retail markets portfolios?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I mean, you picked up the topic of water. I'm just looking at the bottle on my desk here now before I sip it. I mean, it's going to become a scarcity in the world. I think in 5 years' time, 2/3 of the world's population will have a lack of water. And to put that into to real life. I think, just to remind you, Cape Town literally was 3 months away of having no water. I think India's sixth largest city is in the same situation. So it's not scaremongering, it's actually out there. Mm. I do most of my shopping online. I'm lazy, but I just go down the high street now and there's a lot of shops boarded up. It's the death of the high street, which is quite scary. Robotics and AI is no longer something you just see on the TV. There's, you know, I've got an Alexa at home, it does a lot for me. So it's becoming more and more day-to-day life. So these themes are really relevant. Where do you put it in a portfolio is the question I often get asked. If you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said satellite and it would become more core. A year later, I'm now saying it should be core. So a lot of these are listed securities, they're global equities. Mm-hmm. They are accessing a theme that is just going to grow and grow.
Absolutely. So, gents, I'm surprised we've gotten this long without actually getting onto the subject of costs. I mean, it's such an important area for asset managers, advisors alike. What ways are you using to communicate the value of money that comes with investments and also that comes with, you know, the value of an advisory service?
From our point of view, we're trying to educate the clients. Again, it's all about education. Mm. And showing, because with the press, it's all about cost. Cost this, cost that. And it's missing the point of value for money. And again, it's sitting down with the client and explaining there are certain areas where a passive investment is suitable. Mm-hmm. And if you can go and get a broad generalist UK tracker fund at 10 basis points, why would you pay 90 basis points from a blue chip core active manager? Mm-hmm. But then there are other opportunities where you can add real value, which might have a significantly higher cost, but the added alpha that it generates is greater. And therefore, forget the cost, concentrate on the value for money. From the advice side of the business, we are trying to separate currently the investment side from the advice side.
What's the reasoning behind that?
So the clients will move away when the client has the meeting with the advisor. Mm. Instead of talking about portfolios, they will actually talk about their financial planning needs.
Okay.
So it will include life assurance, pensions, etc., rather than
a much more holistic view of their
very
goals.
Much so. Very much so. Instead of spending the time with the advisor talking about fund A instead of fund B. That's what I'm here for, basically.
And Matt, how are you seeing this kind of communication of fundamental value in the market?
Yeah, I think, first of all, performance is much more important than price, and we've got to get that firmly across to people. I know a well-known rating agency we deal with uses the five Ps. It's people, process, parent, performance and price. So price is clearly factored in. Mm-hmm. I recognise when clients are building models and they're obviously selling that on, they've got to get their OCF, what was known as the TER, down. So they're going to be buying the beta of the market and using more index and ETS within that range. So I recognise that. But a very good active fund that delivers outperformance on a regular basis, the price shouldn't even be discussed. It's what you should be paying.
Mm. Andy, to press you on that point where you made about looking at fundamental value, where the outperformance of potential for active versus passive comes from, can you give us some examples about which kind of areas where you would look more active over passive, say?
Yes, certainly. Smaller companies.
Mm-hmm.
An odd area where I know you've asked me about the active over passive,
yeah,
but emerging markets. Which is a traditional, you would have assumed that was a traditional hunting ground for pure active management. But when you look at the passive alternatives, don't always think of the old way. You've got to look at the new way.
Yeah.
And the new way, whichever way you want to, you know, whatever happens is a passive. So, and that's a wholesale change from our point of view. Previously, it was active, 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 active. Now, it's a case of passive. How much added value does an active manager provide?
Mm.
And if it's not warranted, why make the client pay a higher cost unnecessarily?
Mm.
We've had a whole scale change. We've actually gone from a point of view of now going passive.
Default passive.
Yeah, default passive, unless active actually works. And it's smaller companies, global insurance, and that sort of thing.
I think what is interesting, though, is companies that have charged a performance fee now, that's going to be very, very hard to justify. I remember back in the day, hedge funds were 2 and 20. Those days are long, long gone.
really. What would you see as the future of those kind of models for hedge funds in for a, even a retail advisory model?
Well, there's a lot of multi-asset funds out there now that don't have performance fees and they've got the ability to short and use derivatives. So I think they're coming to more prominence. A long-only manager that doesn't short, in my view, it's a personal opinion, shouldn't be charging a performance fee. They should be investing in the fund and delivering alpha. That's what they're paid to do. The hedge funds out there, it's going to be difficult for them to justify their fees.
This conversation on performance and costs brings me on to kind of the area I'd like to use to close up our conversation, and that's, of course, regulation, which has such a focus on these areas. And it's one that's changed the advisory industry so much. So, Andy, can you tell us a little bit about how regulation has changed the way that your company and you have done business over the last 30 years, or more, even more recently, with the wave of new regulation that's come in?
The new wave of regulation is definitely the real sledgehammer.
Really?
And it's the European directed 10% drop letter.
Tell us more about that. What goes into what triggers it, what triggers and what has to happen from your perspective?
Well, whilst the majority of our business is through the advisory side, we do have a couple of joint ventures with MPS managers, which are obviously discretionary and they're run on platforms. And by regulation, they are compelled to write to the client at the point of a portfolio dropping 10% since the last quarter end. And that is designed to ensure that the client is aware of what's going on in their portfolio, which is great. We've already had through this conversation, it's education, education, education. But the 10% drop does have unintended consequences. And the one that is most important or has the biggest impact is where a client, out of the blue, to a degree, gets that 10% letter. All right, portfolio down 10%. Oh my goodness, I can't afford to lose any more. And it triggers that sell.
Interesting. So it's quite behavioral in that sense, that they wouldn't have been thinking about their portfolio at that time because perhaps they wouldn't have seen that they don't follow it that closely and they've not seen on the news Dow closes however many points below. But because they've received the letter, they now have to think about it, and they're thinking about it in a way that's very clearly associated with this negative impact.
Exactly. It is detrimental. By triggering that response, that sell response, that fear response, you've then crystallised the very point that you were trying to avoid. A loss is only a loss once it's crystallised. And by triggering, whilst the client will see the news, read the newspapers, you know, XYZ index down, whatever, it isn't followed through to their end portfolio because, well, I know that I've got this and I've got that and I've got the other. So this is only one small part of it. By getting that letter, it's suddenly black and white.
It becomes real.
I think, obviously, we've got to educate people. I mean, the media are pretty bad, front page news. You know, it's Armageddon when the market's down. But actually, it should be a good time to be topping up your investments, you know, buy low and sell high. But it is the 10% letter focuses on negativity. I have one particular client that actually sends out letters when they've done 10% or more. And I think that's fantastic. And I applaud that and hope more and more clients will follow suit.
I think that's a really positive note to end on, where you might not be thinking about your investments, your portfolio, and then out of the blue, you get this wonderful letter that says, here you go, 10% up. That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, gents, for joining us today. Matt, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
Do you think we'll see a return of Overland and Sea?
Well, certainly it's only on printed copies, so digital has unfortunately destroyed that, which actually plays back into the themes we were discussing earlier, how we've evolved.
I mean, if you'd like a copy, please do send your name and a self-addressed envelope to 1 Common Street. No, that's all right. Ignore that. That was a joke. And Andy, any more trips around Europe with your unique rally cars?
Yes, we're off to Carfest South down at Jody Scheckter, the old Formula One champion.
Fantastic.
Down at his farm in Hampshire in August.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again to both of you for joining us. Thanks to our wonderful production team for hosting us and our amazing producer, Holly McNulty. If you'd like to find out more about Legal & General Investment Management, be sure to visit our website, lgim.com. Listen again at the same time next week for more LGIM Talks. Thank you and goodbye. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in Legal & General investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.